Our third case for this morning is 10-39-21 and 11-12-92, Roundy's Incorporated against the National Labor Relations Board. And I believe we will hear first from Mr. Gore.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Scott Gore with the firm Lehner, Meuch, and Dombrow, Becker, Levin, and Tomenberg, and I represent Roundy's, Inc. This case started off originally as a labor case, but then through the process turned into a property rights case. When it began with
a
Milwaukee
labor case. It's just a labor case that for the National Labor Relations Board thought that property rights were an important dimension.
Correct. And now we have the National Labor Relations Board interpreting state laws with respect to property rights.
And they don't do that every day? I mean, federal courts interpret state laws on property rights and everything else with abandon.
They do, but it's our position that the National Labor Relations Board is better at interpreting labor laws in the National Labor Relations Act than interpreting state property laws. In this case, you have the Milwaukee Building Trades handbilling customers at Roundy's shops, and they were asking the customers to go shop elsewhere. They had price lists comparing product, and they had coupons where they could go shop elsewhere.
And I can see why the board thought it was important. If you imagine two scenarios, you know, scenario number one, they're standing actually on the property of the store, then the store, like any private property owner, would be within its rights to say, you don't have our permission to be here, you know, go away. Whereas if they're standing, to make it really clear, you know, out on the public street or sidewalk, it's a free country. You can give people coupons for Jewel instead of Pick and Save, or you can say, you know, we don't like this store, and that's fine.
That's correct. And if they're out on the public street, I don't think we, or the public access
well,
near the street.
Well, and so, of course, I've given you the brackets. You know,
yes.
Your case may be somewhere in the middle with these easements, but that's what the administrative law judge takes a look at the request of the board.
Right. And what we're looking at is, if you look at the Lechmere case, Lechmere said, first prove, employer, that you have a colorable argument that you have a property right here. And I think that we have shown that we have this easement in the parking lots and on the sidewalks, and that the courts in Wisconsin have recognized that the easement is a property right.
But that doesn't tell you very much. I mean, there are all sorts of property rights. Some property rights give you the right to exclude everybody, and some property rights are much more limited in nature. The basis of this dispute is whether it's proper to treat Roundy's as such a entitled property owner that the easement allows it to kick these people off.
Right, and I believe even the board concedes that the easement carries with it by implication the right to do what's reasonably necessary to fulfill the enjoyment for which that easement is granted.
And what's that? I mean, as a finding of fact, the ALJ concludes that the picketers were quite peaceful, they're giving handbills, they're not blocking the entrance to the door, people can come and go, maybe they'll be persuaded not to come in, but that's not the same as blocking it.
No, that's true, and I believe the purpose of the easement in this case, you've got a parking lot which you have the easement for, the purpose is for cars to be able to come in and park, so it's the ease of the customer to get to the store. The sidewalk is there for the enjoyment of the customer and the enjoyment of the business to further the business purpose, to sell its product. The purpose of those easements is not to allow someone on the property to say, hey, don't shop here. Go shop down the street. And, by the way, the people that built this store paid less than what we believe are the area standard
I don't see where you get this from Wisconsin law. I mean, certainly, you know, it's an easement, but you're assuming that it's the same thing as if you owned the parking lot.
Correct, but, Wisconsin law has held that the deed granting the easement defines the right of the landowner. And the easement,
I'm saying you're over-reading what this easement is. The board looks at this food for less case, takes that as its starting point.
And if you look at, for instance, the Weiss case out of the Fourth Circuit, in that case it's very similar to this, that property there was an easement, and they found that the company could properly exclude the handbellers in that case. The O'Neill case, which is somewhat similar here, the court found that the company could not exclude the handbellers, but the message in O'Neill was a little bit different than that here. The message the union handbellers wanted to give in this case was the stores was built by a company and not Roundy's that paid its employees
a lower. Area standards, right? It's area standards picking.
Right. In O'Neill, the target was the actual store. The store has employees inside of it that are being paid lower than the area standard. This is a different case in that the message is so far removed from Section 7. It arguably has Section 7 rights in it because it's trying to raise the area standard. But in this case, it's such the low end of the spectrum that I think you need to look at, does the employer have a colorable property right? And if the employer has just the smallest property right here, I think it supersedes whatever small Section 7 right.
No, I mean, that's actually a finding about labor law that you're making. And the administrative law judge concludes that you failed to show under Wisconsin law that you had a right to exclude individuals from the common areas over which you had this non-exclusive easement. Now, of course, a couple of stores are carved out. I mean, this is not an across-the-board finding. It's very careful. He looks at each lease, each store, and in this case, as often as true, has been knocking around for a while because of, you know, a lot of reasons. But in any event, the finding is against you on this.
Correct. And it's our position that if you look at the leases for the most part are intended for the enjoyment of Roundy's customers, the employees, agents, and invitees.
Well, it's up to the board, though, to decide how this set of property interests, these non-exclusive easements, intersect with labor law and the Section 7 rights and the ability to handbill for area standards information are part of labor law. So it's that intersection. This court normally defers to what the board concludes in that area. We're supposed to.
Yes, and we believe that the board or the ALJ misinterpreted the Wisconsin law, and that Wisconsin law, from an easement standpoint, gives the right of the easement holder to bring an action to enjoin what is unreasonably and immaterially interferes with the intended purpose of the easement. The intended purpose of the easement is to bring people into the store to buy whatever product this company is selling.
The purpose of the easement isn't to set up Roundy's, you know, or Pick and Save personnel out in front of the store, kicking people off or letting people in. That would be full 100% fee ownership. And the Wisconsin statutes don't go that far for this kind of easement.
Well, respectfully, I haven't seen any case where for Wisconsin that is similar to this, where we're looking at whether or not someone can come on to this property mm-hmm. or the easement and try to campaign or to boycott to get customers to go shop elsewhere.
And does that help you or hurt you? Because it seems to me in these areas where judgment has to be exercised, that's precisely where we defer to the board.
Well,
I mean, if you had solid law on this, then you might be in a much stronger position.
I agree with that. I mean, one of the issues we had tried to do was to bring in an expert on Wisconsin property law.
But you don't do that. Did you brief? Did you put his insights into your brief?
We did.
Okay, so we have all of his wisdom before us.
The other issue here is a matter of due process. I mean, we started off with what was essentially a labor case based on discrimination. The charge said that Roundy's is discriminating by allowing charitable organizations on its property but not allowing the union on its property to deliver its message.
Sure, but, I mean, look, due process is notice and an opportunity to be heard. And if the board had all of a sudden in round one come up with a bunch of findings about easements without giving you an opportunity to say anything about it, you might have a plausible claim to surprise, to the inability to do this. You had ample opportunity to ventilate this. You had a whole second round before the ALJ, so I can't see this as a due process problem.
Well, but does the ALJ, does the general counsel get as many bites at the apple as they want? I mean, they're the ones who formed the complaint. The charges filed, the theory of the case was that Roundy's discriminates.
But it was the board that decided to do this. I don't think the general counsel was even the moving force behind the board's decision that, you know, I mean, for all I know, the board may have thought that you had a very strong property interest and the whole case was going to go away on that basis. I mean, needed exploration.
Well, in fact, the whole original case was tried on the premise that Roundy's had a property interest. No one challenged that. It wasn't until the briefing that general counsel challenged that for the very first time.
And didn't the ALJ find against you on that discrimination concept in round one?
The ALJ did. And
so
we,
I'm
expected
that. I'm not sure
that.
How you're harmed by going back to hear more about whether you have exclusivity in the control of that property.
And I understand. And we expected that the board would find, the ALJ would find, that Roundy's discriminated. But if you look at Sixth Circuit cases and cases from this court, they do differentiate between charitable organizations coming on the property and allowing
and
union
campers. I mean, you had all sorts of people coming on.
Right. So, I mean, that I would rather have had that be the ruling, that we discriminated by not allowing the union on when we let the Girl Scouts on. Then at least I have a better appeal to this court, which, you know, I've got to take a bite at this apple first. The second bite's coming later, I'm sure, because there are two other properties in which the board has to rule on the discrimination issue. So our thought is I have to at least deal with the property rights issue first, and I understand that is not my strongest argument in this case, but I believe it's one that has to be made.
Okay, well, if you'd like to save a little time to
yes.
respond, this would be the time to do
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you. Mr. Lauro.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Greg Lauro for the National Labor Relations Board, asking the Court to fully enforce the Board's order today. The issues were framed this morning, so I will jump right into them. As Your Honors just noted, due process requires a notice and an opportunity to be heard, and the company received that in this case at the second hearing. And, of course, prior to the remand, despite their claim that they were surprised by this, they did argue that they had a property interest in their pre-remand briefs, and they did conditionally ask the board to send the case back to remand it in the event the board found that the company's property interest was something that had to be litigated in that case. So in that sense, the company wasn't surprised and got what it asked for.
So is that your response? I mean, Mr. Gore asks the question, you know, how many times can the general counsel switch theories on someone? And I take it that there must be some limit in a particular case. But, so it's your position that they didn't really switch theories?
It's the board's position that this wasn't a case where the theories were switched, or as others have said, the complaint was amended. The board found that the allegations in the complaint necessarily required litigation at the company's threshold burden to prove under state law that it had an exclusionary property interest. The board also reasonably noted there was some confusion here, that although the complaint raised all these issues, although the stipulations, the written stipulations, did not touch on the company's property interest, there was some confusion during the hearing about whether the property interest issue was being litigated. And so the best thing to do was to set the record straight have another hearing, make sure everyone has formal notice and an opportunity to be heard, and that's what happened here, and the company wasn't harmed, especially since at the end of the day it did get what it asked for, which is, if this is an issue, let's have full factual finding on it.
So that's the point where this one store gets removed altogether. Am I correct to recall that one store is now out of the picture?
Right, that's correct. We originally had 26 stores. One's out of the picture. Two are severed for the discrimination issue, which is still pending before the board.
Mm-hmm.
And on the merits, Your Honor, I mean, I think those issues have already been well framed, but the company did fail to meet its burden under Wisconsin law of proving these non-exclusive easements. A right to merely use the property in conjunction with others granted it the right to kick off these handbillers, and again, it's been touched on. The leases themselves do not explicitly grant any such right, which is notable because Wisconsin courts construe easements narrowly. As has also been discussed, a prerequisite for such an action is proof of material and substantial interference. The board, the ALJ, reasonably found there was no such proof here. And so, putting all that together, the board reached a reasonable conclusion that this burden has not been proven and therefore found a violation. Unless Your Honors have other questions for the board, I thank the court for its time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Ho.
Thank you, Your Honor. Do I still have 5 minutes?
You have, yes, you're 5 minutes.
May it please the court. I'm here to represent the Milwaukee Building and Construction Trades Council. I want to start with the argument regarding the burden of proof. What cases like Leishman and Babcock address is that an employer has the right to oppose his property against third parties. Those cases assume that the third-party activities occur on property that was actually owned by the employer.
But I thought the whole point of the board's concern about this is, as you well know, there are a great number of different property interests that state law recognizes, and they carry with them varying degrees of right to exclude. And so if Wisconsin law for this kind of easement had a fairly robust right to exclude, then maybe the store is within its rights to do that. I mean, it's understandable that a store doesn't want somebody standing in front saying, "This is a terrible store, don't go in."
That's correct, Your Honor. But Ronnie's burden to prove their property interest. Because the Supreme Court cases do not address what procedures to go through to prove that a property in fact.
So that's a question of fact. It isn't really a question of fact. They have leases, and I know it took them a while to produce these leases, and that would have, that unfortunately slowed things down. But once you have the underlying arrangements in front of you, the nature of the property interest is a question of law.
But if you look at the Food for Less case, for example, the burden is on Rondi to point to case law that gives you the right to exclude in this case.
Okay.
And Rondi's admitting their argument, there are no Wisconsin cases similar to these facts.
What about the apparently long pattern of toleration? It seems that there was evidence in this record that the security personnel, for example, at Rondi's regularly called the police if homeless people were hanging around or with other undesirables were there.
Right, Your Honor, I think that's covered by the Wisconsin adverse possession statute, and the practice has not gone long enough to satisfy the requirement of those statutes. So Rondi's has not acquired any additional property rights through his practice.
Okay.
And if you look at the actual case law and look at the statutes around these sites to claim his property interests, this argument completely falls apart. The two statutes that around these sites do are both procedural statutes. In other words, assuming you have an independent legal right, you can then use 844.01 as the procedure for adjudicating that right. Then you can use 840.03 as the potential remedies for that violation. Those statutes do not give rise to an independent cause of action for Roundy's to defend property interests. If you look at the case law that Roundy's cites, all they talk about are physical obstructions to an easement. There's no dispute that has not occurred in this case. The council
I understand there's no physical obstruction, but I guess The board has no particular expertise over Wisconsin property law. I mean, I think we can agree with that. I'm sure the ALJs are just as able to look up the laws as any judge, but there's nothing special about labor law in Wisconsin property law. So that might have some implications for the standard of review here. I mean, do you think we should just take a fresh look at Wisconsin law and see if it gives a possessory interest in the easement, or do you, how does that get worked out in your view?
No, Your Honor, I think you should. I think the board's property analysis inherently tied into a Section 7 analysis. Therefore, some deference should be paid to the board's decision.
Wait, you've lost me. I mean, the question of the law on property gets mixed in with their decision is to.
Right, because the board doctrine is if there isn't a property interest and there's automatic interference.
The determination of whether the property interest is the primary first step. Are they entitled to deference in their decision as what is the property interest?
I think they're entitled to some deference, less than their interpretation of the Act or Section 7,
how
but
much?
I didn't hear the last part of that.
I said, how much deference are we supposed to do? You can maybe quantify it. Apparently you are.
I don't think case law directly speaks to the subject, but I think if it's a close case, you should defer to the board's decision.
Do you suppose that the judges like the three of us might have the same qualification to determine the status of the condition of Wisconsin property laws?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's why I think.
Why we give deference to anybody?
Because I think the board's property interest analysis is tied into a Section 7 analysis.
I think you don't mean that we defer to what they think Wisconsin law is, but once you figure out what Wisconsin law is, then the implications for labor policy might be something that the board has something to say about. But
right. But
you need to be careful about how you sequence this.
And Your Honor, what I want to point out is regardless of how much deference you pay, if you look at 844.15, of the Wisconsin statutes. What that statute says is if you do not have possession, you have to do two, and Rondy's, there's no dispute, it's an easement holder in this case, Rondy's did not have possession. You have to do two things before you can file a suit.
It had non-exclusive possession. It had a form of possession.
Well, there's case law such as Gallagher holding the easement interest. It's not possessory interest under Wisconsin law.
Okay.
And if you don't have possession, there are two things you have to do before you can bring an action claiming interference. One is you have to go to your landlord and ask for the landlord's assistance. Two is the landlord has to refuse to help. There's no dispute that Rondy's kicked the council off his property without ever going to the landlord, without ever satisfying the standing requirements of the Wisconsin statute. Therefore, regardless of how much deference you pay, Rondy's does not have standing in this case to bring an independent action claiming interference with the property interest. So ultimately, Rondy's has failed to meet its burden of proof. Say, okay, if a case has been food for less, that under Wisconsin law, he has the right to kick anybody off his property because he only has an easement interest rather than an actual possessory or ownership interest. For those reasons.
I'm saying this in a very strong way because surely Rondy's would have the right to prevent somebody from blocking the entrance to its store.
They would, but under Wisconsin law, they have to go to the landlord first and ask for the landlord's help.
That, you think? That's a strong claim. Okay.
For those reasons, the board's decision should be upheld. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Gore?
Just very briefly.
Well, when you start with the last one, do you think that Wisconsin law requires they go to the landlord before they can kick somebody out of locking the door?
I wouldn't think so because the Wisconsin law allows for the easement holder to enjoin what is unreasonably and material interferes with the intended purpose of the easement. So here, if you've got blocking of ingress and egress, I think that interferes with the intended business purpose of the company. And in this case, at least from our standpoint, is if you're standing out there saying, go shop elsewhere, and here's a coupon, by the way, for $5 off milk, that interferes with the business purpose of that particular company. And I think also...
But, of course, the message does take you back into the Section 7 rights. You can figure out the property rights in the abstract, but Section 7 allows people to exercise their rights under the labor laws.
It certainly does. And in this case, though, the Section 7 right is so far at the end of the spectrum.
Well, maybe to you. Apparently the council thinks that it's right up at the front of the line.
If they're organizing employees, I mean, that's the strongest Section 7 right, granted. I go back to my days of working with the board. I mean, those are the strong rights. I think in this case the board doesn't even get to a labor issue, though, because at the first instance they say, look, you don't even have a property right here, so we're not even going to get into the labor issues. We're only going to deal with this property issue. And I think this court can just as well deal with the property issues. Should you defer to the board's rulings on property rights issues? I mean, I think this court...
What if we thought, as the board did, that the property right is one of those intermediate rights, that there is no unqualified right to exclude from the entire area as long as perhaps there's reasonable ingress and egress, which on these facts there is, you know, and at that point, why doesn't the board get to balance the rest of it?
Well, granted, I think the board, once you do find that you get past the property right, then the board will determine whether or not there's discrimination or not. And I think that's going to be an issue in the second round of cases. But I think in the first instance, this court can just as well find whether or not there's a property interest.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.